Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are doing something a bit different today. Usually we take a topic and we look at it from 10,000 feet. Today, we are landing the plane. We're taxiing right into the hangar.
We are popping the hood, getting our hands dirty.
We really are, because we are tackling a beast of a topic that I know a ton of you have requested. We're talking about architecting the ultimate enterprise resource planning system, an ERP.
And a management information system, the MIS.
Right. But, and here is the kicker, we are looking at this through a very specific lens today.
Yeah, we aren't looking at this from the perspective of, you know, a Fortune 500 CTO with a team of 300 developers.
Exactly. We are looking at this for you, the architect using AI.
Which is such a fascinating paradigm shift.
It is. Imagine you're a technical person. You understand systems. You get logic. You know how data should flow through a business. But maybe you aren't a native coder.
Right. You aren't exactly writing Rust or C++ in your sleep.
No. You're using LLMs, Claude, GPT, whatever your tool of choice is, to help you write the actual syntax. You are the architect, and the AI is the bricklayer.
Which is a remarkably powerful position to be in. But it's also dangerous.
How so?
Because if you just log into an AI and ask it, hey, build me an inventory system, what does it do?
It probably gives you the most generic thing possible.
Exactly. It gives you the average of the internet. It spits out a standard CRU-based spreadsheet-style database.
And for the kind of complex manufacturing we're diving into today, that is a massive trap.
That's a total dead end.
It really is. So today we are unpacking a specific architectural study on the DAG Event Sourcing Tool Hub. It proposes two absolute superpowers to solve this specific problem.
Two concepts that, honestly, they sound a little scary at first.
They do sound intimidating. DAGs and event sourcing.
Right. Directed acyclic graphs and the concept of storing history, not just the current state.
Mm-hmm.
But they are incredibly intuitive once you actually see them in action.
We have a massive amount of ground to cover. We're going to look at why standard spreadsheets fail for complex products. We're going to break down this Daggett concept using a really cool example involving trading cards.
I love that example from the source material.
It makes it so clear. We'll also talk about the soft code discipline, basically how to organize your files so your AI doesn't get completely confused and hallucinate a bunch of junk.
And we are going to lay out a roadmap. A literal step-by-step guide on how you can build this without breaking your existing business.
Plus, we're going to get into the weeds on the bottlenecks. We'll talk about database traps like Toast, which is huge, and how to actually roll this out iteratively.
So should we just jump right into the core problem?
Let's do it. Why can't I just use a standard database? If I'm printing stuff or manufacturing widgets, why can't I just have a row in a database that says job ID 123 status printing?
Well, you can. And to be fair, that is what 90% of systems out there do.
Yeah.
And for 90% of businesses, that's totally fine. If you are selling t-shirts online, you have a size and a color, done.
You just ship the shirt.
Exactly. But the source material highlights a specific domain here, complex manufacturing. They specifically use printing as the backdrop. But this applies to literally anything where the product is a composition.
A composition. Let's define that for the listener.
Think about a product that isn't just a single monolithic thing. It's made of parts, and those parts have processes. The example they use is a pack of trading cards.
Which sounds simple.
This sounds incredibly simple. It's the pack of cards. You buy it at the store. You rip the foil open. You get some gum. You get the cards.
Right.
But think about how a factory actually makes that pack. You have a front image on the card. You have a back image. Maybe you have a rare foil insert card.
Okay.
Now imagine you want to apply a glossy UV coating to the cards. Do you apply that to the foil wrapper?
No.
Do you apply it to the cards? Yes. But which side? Maybe just the front needs the gloss.
Okay, I'm following. It gets specific quickly.
Now add a lamination layer. That lamination might actually sandwich the front and the back paper stocks together. It physically connects them in the real world.
I see where this is going. If I am using a spreadsheet or a standard tree structure for my data, like folders on my computer, I have to put that lamination step somewhere.
And that right there is the tree versus graph dilemma. In a standard tree model, every child has exactly one parent.
Like an organizational chart.
Perfect analogy. Everyone has one boss. So if you have a front paper stock and a back paper stock, and they both share this single lamination process in the factory, where do you put the lamination node in your database?
If it's a tree, I guess I'd have to copy it. I'd have a lamination listed underneath the front stock and then a totally separate lamination listed under the back stock.
Precisely. You are forced to duplicate the data just to make it fit the tree structure.
And that's a nightmare.
It's an absolute nightmare. You've duplicated reality. Now, let's say the price of lamination goes up. You have to remember to update it in two different places.
Or what if I want to calculate the total cost of the card?
That is the real kicker. Your system might accidentally sum it up twice. Whoa. You are double counting the cost because the computer thinks there are two separate lamination steps, when physically on the factory floor, there is only one.
This is exactly where the DAG comes in, directed acyclic graph.
Yes. A DAG allows a node to have multiple parents.
Okay, so break that down for the trading card.
So in our trading card example, you have one single lamination node. It sits there in the database, unique and singular, and both the front node and the back node draw a line pointing down to it.
They both point to the same shared process.
Exactly. They share the dependency.
So it's not a hierarchy anymore. It's a network.
It is a network of dependencies. The directed part of DAG means the arrows only go one way. Usually they point from the finished product down to the raw materials.
Right.
And the acyclic part just means you can't have a loop. You can't have the lamination dependent on the card, which is dependent on the lamination.
Because that would be an infinite loop and your computer would catch on fire.
Exactly. It would just crash the system.
Okay, so we have this graph. It models reality much better than a spreadsheet ever could. But as a technical architect using AI, how do I actually build this? Because the source material gets very specific here. It talks about a flat map structure.
This is a critical technical detail for you listening out there. Your first instinct might be to tell the AI to store this graph as a giant nested JSON object.
Like a Russian nesting doll.
Exactly. The product contains the pack. The pack contains the card contains the layer contains the ink.
Right, that seems natural. It visually looks like the physical object.
But imagine you want to find a specific layer somewhere in that mess just to change its color. Or say you want to find every component across the entire product that uses red ink.
Oh.
In a nested structure, you have to write code to dig. You have to traverse down, check this branch, go back up, check that branch.
That sounds slow.
It's slow, and more importantly for our architect, it is messy code to write. It's recursive and complicated for an AI to get right every time.
So the solution is this flat map.
Yes. Imagine a simple dictionary in Python or AshMap. Every single node, whether it's a card, a coding, a process, or a sheet of paper, has a unique ID.
Just a string of characters.
Right. And you just throw them all into one big flat list. Node 1, node 2, node 3. They're all peers at the top level.
So if I want node 55, I don't have to dig through a tree to find it. I just ask the dictionary for node 55.
Exactly. It is an O1 lookup, instant access.
Okay, but how do they connect if they are just in a flat list?
Inside node 55, it just has a list of IDs for its children and a list of IDs for its parents. It's just holding references.
That seems so much cleaner, especially for the AI to handle. If I tell Claude, go find the lamination node, it doesn't have to write a complex recursive crawler. It just looks up the type in the flat list.
Correct. It is so much easier to prompt an AI to work with a flat list of references than a deeply nested tree.
And speaking of types, the source material introduces the concept of a universal node schema. They use a data class called ConfigNode.
Yes, this is your fundamental building block.
Let's unpack that for a second. What is actually inside this universal node? Because if we are building a whole ERP out of this, it needs to be robust enough to handle anything.
It is surprisingly simple, which is exactly why it works so well. You have an ID. You have a so is this a layer, a process, a material?
Okay.
You have a list of children IDs and a list of parent IDs. And then crucially, you have an attributes dictionary.
And that attributes dictionary is the flexible part.
That is the magic.
Okay.
If it is a printing node, the attributes inside that dictionary might be ink, color, and resolution.
Right.
But if it's a shipping node, the attributes might be delivery address and weight.
So you don't need to change your actual database columns every time the factory invents a new manufacturing process.
Exactly. And this brings up the node type registry mentioned in the source. They say this allows you to add something like foil stamping or die cutting without any SQL migrations.
This is huge for business agility. In a traditional ERP, if the business owner walks in and says, hey, we just bought a $500,000 foil stamping machine, the developer has a panic attack.
They really do, because they have to go into the database, add a new table called foil stamping, add specific columns for foil color, heat temperature, pressure.
Then they have to run a database migration.
Which requires downtime. It can break existing queries. It's a whole big project.
But with the registry and the universal node,
you don't touch the database. You just define a new rule in your Python code. You say, hey, system, there's a new type called foil stamping. It requires an attribute called color.
You just register it in the software logic.
Right. The database structure, that flat list of generic nodes we talked about, it doesn't care. It just happily stores the new node with the new attributes in that JSON blob.
It sounds like we are completely decoupling the business logic from the rigid database structure.
We absolutely are. And that is a recurring theme you'll see in this deep dive. We are trying to make the system flexible enough that the database architecture never becomes the bottleneck for the business.
Okay, so that covers the what. The DAGA beautifully describes the product structure, the bill of materials, the recipe. But an ERP also needs to track the when.
Right, the timeline.
What is currently happening to this product on the floor. And this is where we get into the second superpower, event sourcing.
This is honestly my favorite part of the whole architecture because it challenges the single most common habit in database design, the status column.
I am so guilty of this. I think everyone who has ever built an app is, you just write update jobs, set status printing. It feels so clean and efficient. What is actually wrong with doing that?
Think about what you just did to the data. You literally overwrote the previous state. The database now knows the job is printing. But does it know when it started printing? Does it know how long it sat in the pre-press queue before it started printing?
Also, no.
Does it know if it was actually in the printing stage yesterday, got rejected for a quality issue, went back to pre-press for fixes, and is now printing for the second time?
No. All of that context is completely gone. I just have the current snapshot.
Exactly. Your system has amnesia. You've lost the entire timeline of the factory. The source material uses the accountant analogy. And it fits this perfectly. Imagine if your bank worked like a standard relational database.
Okay, I'm terrified already.
You deposit $100. The bank updates your single balance column to $100. Then you buy a coffee for $5. They overwrite that cell to $95.
Right.
Now, if you called the bank and asked, hey, what exactly did I spend my money on yesterday? They would look at you and say, we have no idea. We only know you have $95 right now.
That would be an incredibly illegal bank.
It would be shut down immediately. Banks use ledgers. They never, ever erase the balance. They append a transaction.
A credit or a debit.
Right. Event sourcing is just applying that rigorous ledger logic to everything in your business, not just the money.
So instead of changing the status column, we add a transaction to a list?
We emit an event.
Yeah.
An immutable record of something that actually happened in the real world. Job created. Normalization completed, sheet imposed, station completed.
And immutable means we can never, ever change it.
Never. You cannot rewrite history.
But what if an operator makes a mistake? What if they click print and complete, but it actually jammed?
You still don't change the old event. If you made a mistake, you emit a new correction event, like printing reverted or job mark is jammed. But that original mistake stays in the permanent log.
Because it actually happened. The mistake was made.
Exactly. This provides a complete 100% accurate, auditable trail of everything that has ever happened in your business.
Okay, but logistically, how do I know what the current status is? If I have a list of 1,000 historical events for one single job, do I have to read all of them just to see if it's done?
Yes. You replay them. This is a concept called deriving state.
Deriving state.
Right. To find out where the job is right now, today, you grab an empty job template in memory, and you play the events forward one by one in chronological order.
Like fast forwarding a tape.
Exactly. Yeah. The first event says created, so the state becomes created. The next says printing started, so the state updates to printing. You just do that really fast until you run out of events. The final result is your current state.
That sounds computationally expensive, replaying history every single time I want to know if a job is done.
It can sound that way, but think about it. For a single job, replaying 50 or 100 events takes microseconds. Modern computers are absurdly fast at processing linear arrays in memory.
That's true.
And the benefit for your AI coding assistant is massive because the logic to apply those events, the code that says if current status is X and event Y happens, then new status is Z, that logic is a pure function.
We are back to pure functions. This is the soft code bonus mentioned in the outline. Let's dig into that for the listener.
Yes. A pure function is a concept from functional programming. It means the function relies on nothing but its explicit inputs.
State plus event equals new state.
Exactly. It doesn't need to look up anything in a database. It doesn't need to check the system clock or make an API call. It just does math on the inputs provided.
Which means I can ask the AI, I can go to Claude and say, write a Python function that takes a job state dictionary and a printing finished event and returns the updated job state dictionary.
And the AI will write perfect, instantly testable code for that. It doesn't need to know you're using Supabase. It doesn't need to know about your complex API keys or network setup. It is just pure isolated logic.
That makes the system incredibly robust. It's so easy to test because there are no external dependencies to mock up.
Exactly. Okay, so let's connect these two superpowers. We have the DAG, so the product structure, and we have event sourcing, tracking the history of what happens to it. The source material claims this specific combination unlocks what they call the killer app.
The millisecond pricing engine.
This is where the actual ROI comes in for the business.
Mm.
In the legacy way of doing things, that rigid tree model we talked about earlier, quoting a complex job, is a performance nightmare.
Why is it so slow?
Because of how the database queries cascade. Let's go back to our pack of trading cards. You have maybe 20 different nodes, cards, wrappers, inserts, special foil coatings.
Right.
To calculate the final price, the old legacy system has to ask the database a question. Hey, database, what is the price of this specific red ink?
And it waits for the answer.
Then it asks, okay, what is the price of this specific glossy paper? Then what is the hourly labor rate for the lamination machine?
It's an incredibly chatty conversation over the network.
It's the classic N plus one query problem, mm-hmm. but on steroids. You might do 200 separate database round trips just to price one single pack of cards.
And every network trip adds latency.
Exactly. It is I/O bound, input output. It takes seconds to resolve. And if you have a customer waiting on the phone or a user on your website waiting for their shopping cart to load, a few seconds is an absolute eternity. They will just leave.
And the DAG solution fixes this entirely?
It flips the script completely. It uses a very specific three-step process.
Yeah.
Step one is preload.
Reload.
Instead of asking the database 200 individual questions, you fetch the product configuration and all the factory rate tables in one go.
Wait, you grab the entire price list for the whole factory at once?
Everything. The material costs, the labor rates, the machine appreciation, all of it. Usually in just 1 to 3 queries total.
Isn't that a massive amount of data to pull?
Not really. Text data is tiny. The entire rate table for a big factory might only be a few megabytes. You load all of that directly into the application's RAM. That's step one.
Okay, so now all the data is in memory. What's step two?
Evaluate. This is where it becomes pure math.
Yeah.
You traverse the DAG, but you do it from the bottom up.
Bottom up. So starting at the raw materials.
Exactly. You start at the very bottom leaves of the graph, the paper, the ink. You calculate their exact cost. Then you move up one level to the printing process node. You add that labor cost.
Okay.
And you move up to the lamination node.
And here is where the memoization comes in, right? The outline calls this the secret sauce.
Yes. Remember the diamond dependency we talked about, that lamination node that is shared by both the front and the back of the card.
Right. They both point down to it.
In a traditional tree structure, the system would calculate the complex lamination cost for the front of the card. And then, when it got to the back of the card, it would stupidly calculate that exact same cost all over again.
Wasting CPU cycles.
Exactly. But in the DAG pricing engine, when the traversal hits that lamination node the first time, it calculates the cost once.
Mm.
Then it stores that final number in a temporary memory cache. That is memoization.
Ah, so when the back node eventually asks for the lamination costs,
the engine just says, hold on, I already did that complex math. Here is the number from the cache.
Yeah.
It doesn't recalculate anything.
So if you have a highly complex product with tons of shared parts or processes, you aren't paying the calculation penalty twice for any of them.
Exactly. And because this is all happening in RAM, with absolutely zero database calls during the calculation phase, it transforms the quoting process. It goes from taking multiple seconds, because it was I/O bound, to taking literally milliseconds.
Because now it's CPU bound, it's just processing logic.
Right.
That is the difference between a sluggish, frustrating internal tool that your sales team hates and a real-time instant quote engine you can put on a public e-commerce website.
It changes the business logic entirely. If quoting takes 2 milliseconds, you can write an algorithm to run 5,000 quote variations in 10 seconds just to optimize your profit margins before presenting the best option to the customer.
That is incredible. All right. This all sounds magical, but we promised the listener we would be realistic. We need to talk about the bottlenecks, the gotchas.
They're definitely gotchas.
The source material devotes a whole section to storage and technical bottlenecks. Let's set the stage. The recommended stack here is Supabase, which is managed Postgres, and we're heavily utilizing JSONB columns.
Right, which is a very powerful, very modern stack.
But Postgres has a specific quirk that can completely kill this beautiful architecture if you aren't careful. It's called TOAST.
TOAST. T-O-A-S-T.
The oversized attribute storage technique.
It sounds tasty, but it is an absolute performance killer if you fall into the trap.
Yeah.
Here is the deal with Postgres. It is phenomenally good at storing rows of relational data, but it inherently assumes those rows are relatively small.
Right, standard text fields, numbers, dates.
Exactly. But if a single column gets too big, and in Postgres, too big specifically means over about 2 kilobytes, Postgres panics a little bit. It says, whoa, this data is too big to keep neatly in the main table layout.
So what does it actually do with it?
Behind the scenes, completely invisible to you, it compresses that oversized data and physically moves it to a separate hidden storage area on the disk. That hidden area is the toast table.
Okay, so it compresses it and moves it. Why does that matter to our architect?
Because reading from that separate toast table requires extra disk seeks. It has to go find it, pull it out, and then decompress it before it can give it to your application. It is slower, much slower.
Oh, I see the trap. If I have this beautiful flat map of my product, the DAG, with all its nodes, all the custom attributes, everything, and I just dump that entire graph into one single JSONB column in my database.
You will hit that 2 kilobyte limit almost immediately. A complex manufactured product with 50 nodes will be entirely toasted.
And so every single time I try to load a product to look at it, the database has to go fetch this massive compressed blob, decompress it, and serve it up.
Yes. Your performance will fall off an absolute cliff.
Mm-hmm.
You might see query times jump from a snappy 10 milliseconds to 500 milliseconds or worse.
That is a massive difference. So what is the fix? Because we still want to use Postgres and JSONB.
The fix is what the source calls the hybrid storage strategy. You do not store the entire graph as one single blob.
Okay.
You store one row per node.
One row per node. So if the card has 50 pieces, that's 50 rows.
Exactly. You create a config nodes table. Each row represents just one tiny piece of the product. The attributes for that specific node, just the ink color or just the paperweight, are very small, maybe 100 or 200 bytes.
Well, under the 2 kilobyte toast limit.
Exactly. It stays in the fast main table storage.
So when I want to load a product, I'm just selecting a bunch of lightweight rows.
Right. You just run select from config nodes where product XX. Postgres is unbelievably fast at returning 50 tiny rows.
Mm.
It pulls them instantly. Then your Python code, though the soft code, takes those 50 flat rows and reassembles them into the connected graph structure in memory.
That is such a critical distinction for the listener. Keep the database rows tiny and dumb. Do the smart assembly in the application layer.
Right. It keeps the database happy and fast, and it keeps your application snappy.
Okay. While we are on the topic of the database, we need to address security, specifically RLS row-level security.
This is crucial if you are building a system with AI.
Right. This is a Postgres feature that Supabase makes really accessible, isn't it?
Yes. In a traditional legacy web app, security is handled in the application code. You write a SQL query like select from orders where customer equals current still. You have to remember to manually type that where clause onto every single query in your entire code base.
And if you forget it even once.
You just leaked customer B's confidential pricing data to customer A, game over.
And if you are relying on an AI to write your SQL queries.
Exactly. The AI doesn't know about your business context. The AI might easily generate a query that forgets to add the security check. You cannot trust it blindly.
Yikes. So how does row-level security fix this AI blind spot?
RLS moves the security logic out of the application and down into the database itself. You define a strict policy at the database level.
Mm-hmm.
Users can only ever see rows where the customer exactly matches their authentication token.
So even if the AI writes a totally dumb, insecure query that just says, select from orders.
The database effectively steps in and says, nice try, application. I'm silently appending that security where clause for you.
Ah, wow.
It guarantees multi-tenancy isolation at the lowest possible level. The data literally cannot be queried by the wrong user. It's a massive safety net that allows you to trust your AI a little more when generating code.
That is fantastic. Okay, one more gotcha from the source outline. Eventual consistency. Now, whenever I hear eventual consistency, it sounds like a compromise. It sounds like my data is wrong for a little bit.
It is a trade-off. We talked about event sourcing earlier, writing every action to an immutable log. That is the right side of the architecture. It's called the command side.
Right.
But an ERP isn't just about writing data. We also need to read data all day long. We need factory dashboards. We need a job board on a TV screen that shows all active jobs in real time.
And we just established that replaying 1,000 events for every single job every time the TV screen refreshes would be way too slow.
Correct. So we separate the reads from the writes. We build what are called projections.
Projections.
These are separate, highly optimized read-only tables. Think of them like materialized views. You might have a prod job board table or a Proud Waste Report table.
And how do those get updated if we are only writing to the event log?
When a new event happens, say, job created it hits the event log, then a database trigger fires or a background worker script picks up that event, and it updates the static proj job board table.
But that background process takes a tiny bit of time.
Right. Maybe 10 milliseconds, maybe a full second if the server's under heavy load.
So there is a brief window, a moment in time, where the event physically exists in the log, but the dashboard hasn't updated to reflect it yet.
And that gap is eventual consistency. The dashboard might be 1 second behind reality.
Is that a problem for a business?
For an ERP? Generally, absolutely not. Think about the physical world. If a printer operator finishes a pallet and they hit complete on their tablet,
right,
and the manager's dashboard updates 2 seconds later, does it matter?
No. 2 seconds is nothing in a factory.
Exactly. It matters if you are building a high-frequency trading algorithm on Wall Street. It does not matter for manufacturing business logic.
The trade-off is worth it because it keeps the reads lightning fast. The dashboard is just doing a simple select from a static table. It doesn't have to do any math or replay any events.
Exactly. We are heavily optimizing for read speed by sacrificing immediate absolute consistency. It's a very smart trade-off.
Okay, we've covered the model, the DAG, we've covered the history of the events, we went through the pricing engine and the storage bottlenecks. Now let's talk about the actual construction.
How to build it.
Right. This section is specifically for our listener who is using AI to generate the code. The source calls this the soft code discipline, and it outlines a very specific, very strict file structure, core versus adapters.
This is the architectural pattern known as ports and adapters, or hexagonal architecture. It is the intellectual core of your business versus the plumbing. And it is the single most important discipline for the AI-assisted architect.
Okay, break it down. What exactly goes into the core folder?
Inside core, you only put pure functions in frozen data classes.
That's it.
That's it. Zero database connection code, zero API calls. Zero framework dependencies like Flask or FastAPI or Django.
So core is just logic.
It is pure business logic. Rules. Math. If width is greater than 10, then add $5 to the price. That lives in core. It's the intellectual property of your company distilled into code.
And then the adapters folder.
That is the messy world. That is where you write the code to connect to Supabase. That is where you read files from the hard drive. That is where you handle incoming HTTP web requests. That is where all the side effects live.
Why is this strict physical separation of files so vital for the listener using AI?
Because LLMs are brilliant at logic, but they are terrible at maintaining broader context.
What do you mean?
If you tell an AI, write a pricing function for my product, and your code base mixes business logic with database queries, the AI has to guess and hallucinate your database structure.
Oh, I've seen that. It writes a code that tries to connect to a DB table that doesn't even exist.
Exactly. It fails. It throws errors. It's incredibly hard to debug.
But if I enforce this separation?
If you tell the AI, look at this product config data class. Now, write a pure function that takes this class as an input and returns a float representing the total price.
It can do that perfectly every single time.
Because it treats it like a discrete math problem.
Yeah.
It's completely isolated from the messy reality of servers and databases. The source material actually mentions they use over 40 automated validation scripts just to enforce this discipline.
Wait, 40 scripts? Just to check folders?
They literally have scripts that run every time they save. The script checks. Did the developer accidentally import Supabase into any file inside the core folder?
And if they did?
The build fails immediately. It rejects the code.
That is remarkably strict.
It has to be. That strict separation is the only thing that keeps an AI-generated system from turning into an unmaintainable ball of mud over time.
And I guess it also allows you to swap out the plumbing later without breaking the business.
Exactly. If 2 years from now you decide you hate Supabase and want to move to AWS or Firebase, you only rewrite the files in the adapters folder. Your core pricing engine, your core DAG logic, it stays exactly the same. You don't touch it.
That is the dream of modular architecture. Okay, so we have the blueprint. We know the warnings. But how do we actually transition to this?
Or roll out.
Right, because if I have a running business, a printing company with active orders, I can't just tell the factory floor, hey, stop working for 6 months while I rewrite the ERP.
You'd go bankrupt.
Exactly. So the source material introduces the strangler fig pattern,
Such a great name for a software
like
pattern.
the actual plant in the rainforest.
Exactly like the plant. The strangler fig grows a vine around an existing established tree. It slowly wraps around it, replacing it piece by piece, until eventually the old tree dies away and only the new fig tree
So
remains.
you build the new system around the old legacy system.
Without a big bang rewrite. The source outline gives a very clear four-phase roadmap for this. And if you are listening and taking notes, this is your actual project checklist.
Let's walk through it. Phase zero is called foundation. And there is a constraint here that really surprised me when I read it. The constraint is no database.
This is the most counterintuitive part of the whole document, but it's brilliant. Phase zero is built entirely in memory,
Meaning.
meaning you build the config node data classes, you build the graph operations of the code to add node or connect node, you build the complex pricing logic we talked about, and you test all of it with automated unit tests.
But you don't save any of it. Why no database yet?
Because as soon as you introduce a database, you get distracted. You start fighting with connection strings and SQL migrations and toast limits and RLS
You
policies.
stop solving the business problem and start solving database problems.
Precisely. Phase zero is about proving the logic. Can you actually model that complex trading card as a DAG in code? Can you calculate the price correctly in a test script?
If you can't do it in memory.
If you can't make the math work in memory, saving a broken model to Supabase isn't going to help you.
That is fantastic advice. Solve the business problem first, then worry about storing the solution. Okay, so once phase zero works perfectly, we move to phase one, connect.
Now you bring in Supabase, you build your adapters, you create the actual tables we discussed, the config nodes table, the events table, and this is crucial. You run the new system in shadow mode.
Shadow mode, meaning it's running, but it's hidden.
You keep your old Excel sheets or your clunky legacy ERP running. That is still your official source of truth for the company. But every time a new job comes in, you, or a script, also key that exact same job into the new DAG system.
Okay, and then you compare the outputs.
Right. Does the new DAG millisecond pricing engine output the exact same final price as the old trusted spreadsheet?
So you are validating the new math with real-world data, but without risking actual company revenue if there's a bug.
Exactly. You will find edge cases. You'll find bugs where the math doesn't quite align. You fix them. And only when the new system matches the old system perfectly consistently do you move to phase two.
Phase two track.
This is where it gets real. You turn on event sourcing for the actual shop floor. You give the operators tablets. They start pressing buttons that emit job created or station completed.
So they are feeding the new system live data.
Yes. And this is when you build those projections. We talked about the live dashboards. Now the new system isn't just a background calculator anymore. It is an active tracking system.
You are capturing the live beating pulse of the factory floor,
Right. And you are building up that rich, immutable history.
which sets up phase three. Phase three, agentic. This is labeled the future in the source.
This is the massive payoff for all that strict soft code discipline and weird graph math. You now have a perfectly clean DAG that defines the workflow, and you have a perfectly clean event stream that defines the current status.
So everything is machine readable.
Exactly. Now, you can point an autonomous AI agent at it.
What does the agent actually do in this scenario?
The agent can read the DAG to understand what needs to happen to a product. It looks at the graph and says, "Oh, I see this specific trading card job requires a lamination step."
Okay.
Then it reads the event stream to understand what has already happened. It says, "Okay, the events show it has been printed, but the lamination completed event doesn't exist yet."
So the agent can reason about the gap between the plan and reality.
Yes. It concludes, "Therefore, I should schedule the lamination station for this afternoon."
Wow.
The agent creates actual commands in the system. It goes from being a passive observer to an active orchestrator.
Because it trusts the data.
Right. It can optimize the production schedule. It can flag bottlenecks before they happen. It can even automate ordering raw paper from a supplier when it calculates that inventory will run low next week.
Because the data is structured so cleanly, no messy text fields, no ambiguous status columns, the agent doesn't have to guess.
It's operating on deterministic logic. And that is the ultimate goal here. You aren't just building a database to store records so a human can read them later. You are building a digital twin of your physical manufacturing process.
A twin that an AI can actually understand and manage.
Yes.
This has been an incredibly dense deep dive. We've gone from the frustration of dealing with nested spreadsheets to the elegant structure of DAGs, the immutable timeline of event sourcing, and the absolute necessity of the soft code discipline.
And if you take only one single thing away from this whole discussion, it should be this. Stop thinking about your business data as just the current state.
Expand on that. What do you mean?
Most systems out there just store now. What is the balance now? Where is the job now? The move to event sourcing is a fundamental move to data replay. You aren't just storing the state of the object, you are storing the time.
You are storing the entire timeline of the business itself.
That is exactly it. With this architecture, you can literally rewind your entire business to last Tuesday at 2:00 p.m., and your system can tell you exactly what the world looked like at that millisecond.
That is a staggering thought.
And that rich history is the true foundation for machine learning, for deep business optimization, and for the AI-driven future of manufacturing.
So for you listeners out there, the technical architects, the AI builders, the curious mission, if you choose to accept it, is to start with phase zero today.
Start small.
Do not open your database tool yet. Open your code editor. Write the pure logic. Model whatever your company makes as a graph. Prove it works in memory.
Prove the logic first. Worry about persistence second.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.